I am the Provost and Vice President of Academic Affairs here at St. Mary's University. I want to welcome all of you who have come to listen to this, our first Lynn Great Speaker for the 2012-2013 academic year. I'm so delighted to see so many of the St. Mary's faculty and students and staff and alumni in the audience. The Lynn Great Speaker Series was begun in 1990, and it is made possible by an endowment established in the memory of Chu Shi Lin by his widow, Mrs. Chang Lei Chao Lin, and his son, our alum, Vincent Lin, Ph.D. The series is presented to the public as a community service, and for 20 years, St. Mary's has invited visionaries in any number of fields to speak to our university community and to the larger San Antonio community as well. And I want to extend a welcome to those of you from the larger San Antonio community. This year, the focus for our Lynn Speaker Series is the topic Educating for Adaptation and Change. Educating for Adaptation and Change is one of the five characteristics of Marianist education, which basically form the foundation of our educational mission. We chose this topic because as a university and as a nation and, in fact, as a world, we feel that we are on the verge of change which will require adaptation. Everyone is looking to the future now. However, a lot of the future imaginings that we have seem to involve some aspect of peering through the glass darkly. And we seem to be thinking of a future which envisions change, where we will have to adapt to a culture of scarcity. Therefore, Dr. Coulter's topic, Creating a Culture of Abundance, caught my attention because of its positive message about the future. Stephen Coulter is a Pulitzer Prize nominee, and he wants to push your perceived limitations. What he is seeking is nothing less than the big explanation, wrote the Village Voice some 15 years ago, and little has changed. As an award-winning journalist and best-selling author, Stephen Coulter has spent more than two decades at the cutting edge of science, religion, philosophy, culture, technology, and environmental affairs. Stephen Coulter is the founder and director of Flow State University, an international transdisciplinary effort to put Flow State research on a hard science setting. He is co-founder of the Rancho de Chihuahua Dog Sanctuary, the only sanctuary in America with cognitive neuroscience and evolutionary psychology at the heart of its healing mythology, okay, and recently featured on Animal Planet. Quite a bit to get through. He's also a co-founder, along with the Los Angeles Lakers, and the 826 LA, co-founder of the Reporters Gym, a sports writing camp for inner city school kids. His books include New York Times bestseller Abundance, A Small Furry Prayer, West of Jesus, The Angle Quickest for Flight. His award-winning articles have appeared internationally in over 60 publications, including the New York Times Magazine, LA Times, London Observer, Wired Magazine, Discover, Popular Science, Outside, GQ Details, and also ESPN. For PsychologyToday.com, he writes The Playing Field, a blog about the science of sport and culture. He writes a small, furry blog, a blog about dogs and the meaning of life, for Outside.com, and a blog entitled Far Frontiers for Forbes.com. He is the head environmental investigative reporter for Echo Heart. He has appeared on Nightline, CNN, CBC, and NPR, among other media outlets. His latest book, Abundance, was released by Simon & Schuster, and it debuted at number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list, and it stayed on top of the list for more than 2 months. Mr. Coulter recently announced that his new book, The Rise of Superman, is slated for release sometime in 2013. We'll be looking forward to that. In his address, Mr. Coulter lays out how we will soon be able to meet and exceed the basic needs of every man, woman, and child on the planet. And he explains how abundance for all is actually within our grasp. This bold, contrarian view is highly worthy of an audience for the Lynn Great Speaker Lecture. At the conclusion of his presentation, we will have a brief time for questions and answers. So I want you to keep that in mind as we give Mr. Coulter a very warm St. Mary's welcome to the Lynn Great Speaker Series. Mr. Stephen Coulter.
Good evening. You've actually got stuff on my resume that I forgot I did. I'm going to spill this water, so we're going to put it down here. Good. So tonight I'm going to talk a little bit about abundance, and the book itself is about four emerging forces that are appearing today that make it significantly plausible to raise global standards of living over the next 20 to 30 years. So I want to be clear on what I'm talking about. I am talking not about a life of luxury. This is about a life of possibility. I don't mean Mercedes-Benzes and Trump Towers, but I do mean meeting and exceeding the basic needs of every man, woman, and child on this planet. Now, those are very, very bold claims, especially in today's kind of dark, pessimistic world. So before I actually talk about these four emergent forces and back that up, I want to tell you a little bit about why it's so difficult for most of us to believe that the world is actually getting better. So I want to talk a little bit about why our brain keeps us pessimistic. So at the heart of that issue is an information processing problem. Every second of every day, the brain takes in millions and millions of bits of information. We seem to have lost a slide. Weird. Okay, we're going with that. All right. This, by the way, the list that you're looking at, this is a conservative list estimate of the amount of information your brain is taking in every second. This comes from a 1970s textbook. The first time these numbers were actually calculated accurately. The numbers today, depending on who you talk to, can go as high as 400 billion bits of information a second, sometimes up to a trillion bits of information a second that are coming in. This is way, way, way too much data for the brain to process. So a lot of what the brain does is it sifts and it sorts, and it tries to tease apart the critical from the casual. And since nothing is more critical to the organism than survival, the first stop all this incoming information makes is the amygdala. Now, the amygdala is your danger detector. It's an organ that is primed to remain on high alert. It generates emotionally rage, hate, anger, these very, very, very powerful emotions. And unfortunately, in the modern world, the amygdala is almost always on high alert. And there are a couple of reasons why. The first issue is that the amygdala is a very old organ, and it evolved in an era of immediacy where most of the threats we face were of the tiger and the bush variety. But today, in the world we live in, most of the dangers that we deal with are probabilistic. The economy might nosedive. Terrorists could attack. A meteor could impact the Earth. The problem is the amygdala can't tell the difference between actual immediate dangers and probabilistic dangers. Another thing is the amygdala evolved not to be able to shut off until the danger was gone completely. Probabilistic dangers are never, ever, ever gone completely. So on a certain level, at a really basic fundamental level, we are all living at a much heightened state of anxiety simply because of this. Now, this issue is much, much worse in our hyper-connected, always online world. We have today millions and millions and millions of media outlets that are competing for our attention. Can you guys hear me? This sounds like it just went away. I'm okay? Okay. Millions of media outlets competing for attention. And how do they compete? They vie for the amygdala's attention. And the way they do that is by filling the airwaves with negative news. The old newspaper saw, if it bleeds, it leads, works, because the first stop all of this incoming information makes is an organ that is primed to look for danger. So given a dozen news stories out there, the amygdala is going to pick out the darkest, scariest one and focus on that, and it's not going to let the other information in. Considering that we have millions and millions of electronic devices, our cell phones, our tablets, our laptops, on and on and on, and they're all feeding us this negative information, you can understand why we're feeling a little pessimistic. This is only half of the problem. The other half of the problem is because we're taking in so much information, the brain has developed processing shortcuts, information processing shortcuts. These are called heuristics, and we use these all the time. For example, it is really difficult to tell the mood of another person. You would have to ask a lot of questions. You would have to be able to trust their responses. But the brain has developed a really simple heuristic. We look at a person's facial expression. A frown is a information processing shortcut used by the brain to determine mood. So there are thousands and thousands and thousands of these processing shortcuts, and most of the time, they work. When they don't work, as Nobel laureate Daniel Kahneman figured out, they're no longer called heuristics, and then they're called cognitive biases. The problem with cognitive biases is a lot of our cognitive biases keep us pessimistic by design. For example, we have a negativity bias, which is a tendency to privilege negative information over positive information. This serves a really basic survival function most of the time, doesn't work so well in a modern world. We also have loss aversion, which is what keeps us stuck in ruts. Loss aversion is the fear that whatever you have today, if I take it away, whatever's going to come to replace it is going to be worse. On top of that, and this is probably the worst out of all of them for what we're dealing with, we have what's called confirmation bias. Now, confirmation bias simply says we take in information that confirms our beliefs, and anything that doesn't confirm our belief, we don't even process it. It doesn't even register. It's not even impacting the senses. So on its own, this is perhaps not that bad of a problem, but in a world where you're constantly being bombarded by negative information, by national news media that wants your attention, confirmation bias combined with all of these other issues, we end up in a place where we all think we're going to hell in a handbasket and there's not a damn thing we can do about it. But that's not actually the case. So I want to ask you a different question. If all this stuff is going on in our brain and it's keeping us pessimistic by design, what does the world actually look like? So I'm going to give you the 100-year view. In the past 100 years, child mortality has dropped by 99%, maternal mortality by 90%. Income adjusted for inflation has tripled, longevity has doubled, and I have to pause for a second to talk about that. In the entire history of the human species, from the very beginning to the end of the 18th century, our longevity doubled. It went from 21 years to 42 years. And in 100 years, it's doubled again. That's insane. That's incredible. Electricity reduced 20-fold. Transportation 100-fold. Telecom 1,000-fold. If you want a slightly longer view, in the past 500 years, violence has dropped 100%. If you want a shorter view, according to the UN, poverty has been reduced more in the past 50 years than at any time in the previous 500. Unfortunately, while all this is going on, we keep setting our expectations higher and higher and higher. And the most obvious example is we keep redefining what poverty means. Think about this for a second. Today, The average American living below the poverty line has access to running water, flushing toilets, electricity, an automobile, and an air conditioner. 100 years ago, the wealthiest people on the planet had access to none of these things. So the forces that have produced all this change in the past 100 years are primarily technological, and as of late, exponentially growing technology. Now, exponential growth is deceptive, and this is another reason it's very difficult to understand change in today's world. We have a brain that evolved in a linear environment. Now, linear growth is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, etc. Exponential growth is a simple doubling. 2 becomes 4, becomes 8, becomes 16. Very deceptive. If I take 30 linear steps, I'm going to end up 30 feet away or over there. If I take 30 exponential steps, I'm going to end up over a billion feet away or essentially orbiting the globe 18 times. So exponential growth shows up in technology. The most famous example is what's called Moore's Law, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with it. In 1965, Gordon Moore, who in a couple years after this would go on to found Intel, realized that the number of integrated circuits on a computer chip had been doubling every year since the invention of a computer chip. And he thought, wow, that's neat. I'll bet that's going to keep going for 10 more years. Well, it kept going for 10 more years, and 10 more after that, and 10 more after that, and all told, it stayed constant for over 60 years at this point. Exponential growth in computer chips is the reason why the cell phone in your pocket is 1,000 times cheaper and 1,000,000 times faster than a supercomputer from the 1970s. But it's not just computer chips. So Ray Kurzweil and a number of other thinkers have figured out that once a technology becomes information-based, it jumps onto Moore's Law. It starts doubling in this way. So these are a list of some of the technologies that are now advancing exponentially. These are some of those powerful technologies on Earth: infinite computing, networks and sensors, robotics. Synthetic biology is new foods, new fuels, and new medicines, nanotechnology. 3D printing. I want to talk a little about 3D printing. I don't know if you guys know what a 3D printer is. An inkjet printer is a 2D printer. It squirts ink out of a nozzle onto a two-dimensional surface. 3D printer, roughly the same way, except instead of printing in two dimensions, it prints in three, so it'll shoot out plastic and it'll build things up layer by layer by layer by layer. So this, what you're looking at, this is a woman who's a double amputee below the knee, and her legs have been customized 3D printed to fit in her body, a fit on her body. Those were squirted out of essentially an oversized inkjet printer. The guy who does this work is a guy named Scott Summit, and he's a friend of mine. And he told me this great, great, great story that I want to share with you. He did some work with a bunch of kids who had scoliosis, young kids. And in grade school, their whole lives, they've been teased because they have to wear back braces. Every time they go to school, they have to wear back braces. They weren't very popular. They were having a tough time. He got together with used a 3D printer to print back braces that were so cool that they became the most popular kids at school, and kids who didn't have back problems wanted to wear them. So the big deal about 3D printing, among many other reasons, is it democratizes manufacturing. So one thing that's really interesting is you can print a 3D printer from a 3D printer right now. So you need one of these machines, and you can literally duplicate them. But imagine you're a farmer in Africa, and your tractor breaks, and you're short a part. Supply chains aren't around, and the harvest is already in. If you don't get that harvest in, you're going to starve. You're not going to feed your family. And if your tractor's broken, you're stuck because the nearest part is probably 2 months away from you. With a 3D printer, you can download the blueprint from the part from the manufacturer online, push print, and have it within 10 minutes. So 3D printing is the democratization of manufacturing. And another example, there's a guy named Baruch Kashnevis who's at USC. He has developed a 3D printer that prints in concrete. He believes he can print houses for the poor. 24 hours to 48 hours, he can print you a $2,000 house. So this technology is being developed right now for use in places like Haiti or after Katrina, where they're going to need emergency housing very, very quickly. But within a couple of years, we're going to be printing our houses, not building our houses. So I want to talk about why all of this is a big deal. You mentioned resource scarcity a second ago. So resource scarcity is no joke. Right now we use 30% more of the planet's resources in a year that we can renew. You guys probably know this already, but if everybody in the world wants to live with the standard of living of an average European right now, we're going to need three planets worth of resources to pull it off. If everybody wants to live like an average North American, we're going to need five planets worth of resources to pull it off. Now, these figures, by the way, have been out there. You've probably heard them before. I want to tell you that these figures are absolutely true, but they're not quite as static as most people believe. And to explain what I mean, I want to tell you a story about aluminum. I want to tell you a story about Napoleon III, who in the early 18th century threw a banquet for the King of Siam. Huge party, huge banquet. Everybody who came to the banquet ate on silver plates with silver utensils. Napoleon got to eat on gold plates with gold utensils. But the King of Siam, his honored guest, he ate on aluminum plates with aluminum utensils. Because aluminum in the early 18th century was the rarest metal on earth. It was worth more than gold. It was worth more than platinum. The capstone in the Washington Monument is made out of aluminum for this very reason. Now, what's unusual about all this is aluminum was the rarest metal on earth, but it's actually everywhere. 8% of the weight of the world is actually aluminum. The problem is it's always found up, bound up in oxides and silicates. It's basically the ore is bound up in rock. But between 1830 and 1870, four different teams of scientists invented the technology of electrolysis. Electrolysis uses electricity to liberate the ore from the rock so successfully that once the rarest metal on Earth is now so cheap that we use it with a throwaway mindset. So the point here is that technology, used properly, is a resource-liberating mechanism. So energy is a really fabulous example here. You hear about energy poverty. You hear about energy scarcity. The sun provides 5,000 times more energy in an hour than we use in a year. That's 16 terawatts of energy landing on the planet's surface every 88 minutes. It is not about resource scarcity. Is it about accessibility? And there is very, very, very good news here. Solar production, rate of production grew 30% last year. Cost dropped by 50%. In India, where half of their energy comes from diesel, last year solar was half the cost of diesel. An MIT study released earlier in this year says by 2020, in sunnier portions of the United States, like here in San Antonio, solar is going to be 6 cents a kilowatt hour versus 15 cents a kilowatt hour for the average cost of electricity today. I just talked to a guy named Joe Carr who runs a company called Semprius. Semprius earlier this year set a world record for converting the amount of sunlight that hits the solar panel into electricity. This conversion rate has been really, really low. He set a world record with 34%. Conversation, he said it's going to be up to 40% by 2015. That may not sound like a huge deal to you, but at 40% conversion rate, that puts the cost of electricity below the cost of coal, which is the very thing we've been waiting for widespread national adoption. So I want to tell you what happens once we get abundant energy. And by the way, I just talked about solar. The same kind of change is going on. The same kind of exponential growth is going on in wind. It's going on in geothermal. There's some neat stuff in natural gas, and there's some very neat fourth generation, very safe nuclear power that I could end up talking about all night. Not going to. I just want to tell you those technologies are also coming. They're also growing at the same rate as solar. And here's the big deal, among many other things. Right now, there are 925 million people who are starving in the world. That's one out of seven of us goes to bed every night without enough to eat. The problem here is not only do we have hungry people, we have a booming population, just past 7 billion, going to be at 9 billion very, very soon. And we're also running out of arable land. That means we're running out of land that we can actually grow food on. So this is a real problem. And here's a real solution. This is a vertical farm. The idea behind, and this is a real structure, by the way, I'll talk about it in a second, but this exists in Sweden. Vertical farms are a very, very simple idea. The idea is let's move our farms from out in the country where people are not to the cities where people are. This is a big deal for a lot of different reasons. One, by 2025, 70% of everybody on the planet is going to live in cities. So right now, the average food stuff travels 1,500 miles to get to your plate. That is an absolute waste of energy. It's insane. But what's worse is every second, vegetables are out of the ground, for example, their nutritional value is going down. So the fact that we're transporting food this far and this long, it's not just a waste of energy. It's also has a health impact. It has a nutritional impact. So according to calculations done by Dixon Despalme at Columbia, who's one of the big thinkers kind of behind vertical farms, if we move our farms indoors, and originally, by the way, this is a very high-tech, sexy version, Dixon wanted to repurpose old skyscrapers, abandoned skyscrapers in New York City to use to do this. So this is a fancy new version. You can do kind of the retrofitted older version. But using any of them, we can grow 100% of our foodstuffs on 80% less land with 90% less water, zero pesticide use, and zero transportation miles. The only stumbling block is enough energy. And eventually, the goal is to recycle waste to heat these things and power these things. It's a little difficult to get people to want to recycle their waste to power their greenhouses. That's not something most people want to do. But in the interim, this massive increase in solar power bodes very, 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 very well. So I want to talk about another food technology that's coming. In vitro meat, which is the process of growing steak from stem cells. This is a big deal for a lot of reasons. I'm going to jump back. I'm going to tell you one more thing about vertical farms. I'm sorry. The one you're looking at is built by Plantagen International. It's in Sweden, as I mentioned. Here's the other really cool thing. In this vertical farm, which is 10,000 acres, you can grow 100,000 acres of crops in a 10,000-acre area. So that's a massive increase in crop production and food production at a time when we're desperate for it. Now, back to the in vitro meat, which is about growing steak from stem cells, as I said. So there's a lot of reasons why this is absolutely necessary and wonderful and brilliant. First of all, the cattle are energy hogs, horrible energy hogs. The ratio of energy in to beef out is 54 to 1. 70% of the planet's emerging diseases come out of livestock. 40 billion animals are killed a year. 30% of the world's land goes for cattle grazing. And 40% of the world's cereals. We have 1 out of 7 of us are going to bed hungry, and 40% of the world's cereals are going to feed cattle. This is insane. On top of it, we hear about water wars. We hear about drought, especially here in the Southwest. There is enough water in an adult steer to float a U.S. Navy destroyer. So the thing about in vitro meat is it solves all those problems, and it does something else, and this is really cool. Because we're growing steak from stem cells, and I want to tell you that this is doable now. This is not 10 years out. This is not 20 years out. We have in vitro meat today. The only issue is an energy issue. They have to build up the bioreactors so they can scale this up, and it's an energy problem. It is not a technology problem. So the tissue engineering portion of this has already been solved. But here's the cool thing. When you're building your steak from the ground up, you can put omega-3 fatty acids into your steak. You can put salmon oil into your steak. We can make fast food hamburgers that are good for us. The real issue, I'm talking about these two technologies besides the fact that I think they're, you know, interesting and they solve hunger, which is one of kind of my topics here. I want to talk about a bigger problem. I want to talk about some of the kind of unsolvable, really scary problems we're up against, one of which is what's called the sixth great extinction. You may or may not know this. We are in the midst of a giant biodiversity crisis right now. The term scientists use is the sixth great extinction. The fifth great extinction was the one that wiped off the dinosaurs. So on average, globally right now, annually, we are losing 140,000 species. This is a really, really, really big deal. A lot of people don't pay attention to biodiversity, but if you talk to the science community, they will tell you that of everything that we're up against, this is what scares them most. And the reason it scares them most is because of something called ecosystem services. So ecosystem services are all the things that the planet does for us for free that we can't do for ourselves. Climate regulation, pollination services, flood protection, wood growth, disease protection, seed dispersal. The list goes on and on and on. Amory Lovins, who runs the Rocky Mountain Institute and is one of our better thinkers on this topic, calculated a few years ago that the cost of all the ecosystem services we get from the planet for free is $36 trillion. Now, that figure is a big deal. Why? Because it's roughly the size of the global economy. So that means even if we wanted to pay for these things, we couldn't afford to. And I don't know if you guys remember Biosphere 2. Biosphere 2 was the giant dome they built in the desert in Arizona, and they were people tried to live inside for a couple of years. What we learned out of Biosphere 2 is that we can't duplicate ecosystem services. Biosphere 2 was a failure. We couldn't pull it off. We couldn't duplicate what Mother Nature does. So $36 trillion, and we can't reproduce it. So if ecosystem services go away, we can't pay for it, and we can't do it ourselves, and we can't live without it. And the only way to preserve ecosystem services is to preserve biodiversity. Now, this is one of these problems that if you talk to most people, they will tell you it's absolutely unsolvable. That's actually not true at all. People have known, scientists have known since the 60s, that the easiest way you can stop the devastating loss of biodiversity is take land away from the humans and give it back to the animals. And there's all kinds of fancy words for this, megalinkages, and there's a way of talking about it that doesn't sound so cavalier, but that's really the truth. The problem is massively growing population, not enough arable land to feed people. So where are you possibly going to get the land you need to protect these animals? Well, it turns out if you combine the 80% land saving you get from vertical farms and the 30% land saving you get from in vitro meat, these two technologies together can provide more than enough food to feed our massively growing population and still leave more than enough land left over to be repurposed for the animals and stop the devastating loss of biodiversity and preserve ecosystem services. So I wanted to mention that just because it's one of those problems like population, like global warming, that it seems like we're up against and nobody's got a possible solution. Not true at all. There are a lot of possible solutions. There's obviously a lot of will required to do what I'm talking about, but it is not an unsolvable problem by any stretch of the imagination. So I want to talk about one other thing you get if you get enough energy, which is enough water. So I don't know how well you guys can see this photograph. Does anybody recognize it? So in 1990, while the spaceship Voyager was passing Saturn, Carl Sagan had that spaceship turn around and take a very famous photo of the Earth. Does anybody know what it's called? You're looking at the photo. No? Pale Blue Dot, exactly. And the reason this photo is called the Pale Blue Dot is because we live on an aqueous planet. 70% of the planet's surface is covered by water. 97.5% of that water is salt water. Another 2% is locked up in polar ice. So when we talk about water wars, what we're really saying is we are fighting over 0.5% of the water on Earth. Again, this is not a scarcity problem. It's an accessibility problem. So what if there was a technology that could just take a little bit of that salt water, a fraction of that salt water, and convert it into fresh water? Would that solve our problems? Absolutely. And the thing is, that technology is not 10 years out. It's not 20 years out. It's here today. So this is Dean Kamen. I don't know if any of you know him. If any of you know his name, it's probably because you've heard of him because he invented the Segway. But Dean Kamen is actually a really, really amazing medical technology inventor. He's got 440-some patents to his name, National Medical Technology. A bunch of years ago, he was trying to solve a dialysis problem. And one of the big difficulties with dialysis is people who need dialysis need access to really high-quality, injectable-grade sterile water, bucket loads of it. So they usually back up trucks to dialysis patients' homes, and they just pack their garages filled with water. So Dean was trying to solve this problem, and he decided that he tried a lot of different things, and then he kind of lit on the solution that what if he could purify tap water? What if he could take tap water and make it injectable-grade sterile? And he figured out a way to do this. Unfortunately, it required so much energy, you had to rewire your home to pull it off. So Dean started wondering, well, what would happen if I made the device with its own energy source? So he repurposed a Stirling engine from the 1800s, and he created a device that does all this. And when he was thinking about scaling it up, he went, you know, I could keep going as I am, and I could scale it up, and I could improve the lives for tens of thousands of dialysis patients. Or I could work it a little harder and scale it up a little bigger, and I can impact the lives of millions of people who don't have access to fresh water. So he was successful. The device is called the Slingshot. He named it after the slingshot that David used to kill Goliath, and with this slingshot, he's going to slay the giant of water scarcity, I think is how he puts it. Needless to say, the device is astounding. You can take any aqueous substance. It's roughly the size of a dorm room refrigerator. You can take any aqueous substance, latrine water, arsenic-laden water, salt water, brings out injectable-grade sterile water. It runs on less energy than it takes to run a hairdryer. It costs less than 2 cents a liter. And here's the really, really cool part about the slingshot. So you can go to Africa and you can go to parts of Asia and you're going to see on the side of the road, first of all, in Africa, you're going to see all this rotting technology that the United States and other countries dumped into Africa. Oh, they have farm problems? We'll give them tractors. The problem with giving people tractors who don't have access to supply chains and whatnot is once they break, they just completely fall apart. So if you can't maintain these things, it's worthless. It doesn't do you any good. So Dean came and partnered with Coca-Cola, who has the largest distribution and maintenance network in the world. They did a small-scale field trial with the slingshot a couple years ago. It went really, really well. They did a slightly bigger one. It went really, really well. They're now on their final trial. It's a very, very large-scale trial, and it's going very, very, very well. And if they're successful, Coca-Cola is going to roll this technology out in 206 countries by the end of the year. That's kind of amazing. So the first of our forces was the exponential growth rate of technology, and I've kind of talked a little bit about what that's bringing. Dean Kamen brings us is an example of the second of the forces of abundance that I was talking about in the beginning. The second force is what I call the DIY innovator, the do-it-yourself innovator. Now, the big deal here is that for the very first time in the history of the world, individuals or small groups can have an impact that 10 to 15 years ago, only large corporations and major governments could have. Now, I'll give you one simple example. This plane you're looking at, or the spaceship you're looking at, is the spaceship that won the XPRIZE. So I have a co-author on abundance, whose name is Peter Diamandis, and he runs the XPRIZE Foundation. The XPRIZE was a $10 million prize in the 90s for the first team of people who could build a reusable safe spaceship, a spaceship that could go into space twice in 2 weeks carrying three people. Now, this is something that nobody's been able to do. And when Peter came up with the idea of the XPRIZE, he went to every aerospace contractor in the world. And they said, oh, no, this is impossible. You're crazy. You're out of your mind. He went to NASA. NASA said, oh, you're really out of your mind. We spent $300 billion trying to do this, and we had thousands and thousands and thousands of engineers. Peter said, okay, well, thank you very much. A couple years after that, Bert Rattan won the XPRIZE. He was working out of an oversized garage in the Mojave Desert. He worked with 20 other engineers, and for $26 million, they did what NASA and every aerospace contractor in the world said could not be done. So this is a great example of the newfound power of the DIY innovator, but it's one from the 1990s, so it's a little out of date. $26 million is still a lot of money. Another example comes from the year 2000. Craig Venter beat the U.S. government in the race to decode the human genome. The U.S. government set aside 15 years. They set aside $3 billion. Craig Venter came in, and with a small team of people, he did it in under a year for $300 million. And again, that was then. Today, or let's go to 2008. So MIT runs a synthetic biology competition. They call it the iGEM competition. The idea is you take very, very fundamental synthetic building blocks, basically human manufactured cells and things like this, and you put them together and you build new organisms. So in the beginning, when MIT first came up with the idea, people were doing things like, you know, taking glow-in-the-dark jellyfish genes and putting them into cats. So we had glow-in-the-dark cats. It was neat. It's a neat hack for sure, but not world-changing, obviously. In 2008, this is just one example, but in 2008, the iGEM competition was won. By the way, this is a high school and college student competition, primarily high school. 2008, it was won by a team of high school students and college students from Slovenia, which, by the way, is not a country that has any kind of synthetic biology industry whatsoever. They were working on primarily used equipment. They came up with a vaccine for the most common form of an ulcer. Now, this is a world-class biopharmaceutical result created by high school and college students working on used equipment. This is what's possible today. This is the newfound power of the DIY inventor. I want to tell you another story about DIY inventors. This is one of my favorites. So Chris Anderson, who is the editor-in-chief of Wired magazine. Chris has five children, and he's something of a geek dad. So a bunch of years ago, Chris decided he was going to spend the weekend with his kids, and they were going to build a Lego Mindstorm robot, and they were going to fly a remote-controlled airplane. And the robot bored his kids to death. They were like, "Dad, where are the lasers?" And the airplane crashed right off the bat. Just flew it, and it just crashed, and that was the end of their weekend together. So as Chris was kind of sifting through the wreckage, there's a little AI controller in the Lego Mindstorm robot. And he went, "Well, I couldn't fly the plane. I couldn't control it. So what happens if I can find the Lego Mindstorm robot AI controller with the remote-controlled airplane?" He didn't know anything about autonomous aircraft. He didn't know anything about drones. He didn't know anything about anything. But he started an online group called DIY Drones. Try to do this. Group got very, very popular. Within a year, they had something like 37,000 members. And they successfully put the plane and the Mindstorm robot together, and then they got a little ambitious. So the cheapest military-grade drone or UAV on the market is the Raven. It retails for $35,000 for the plane, $250,000 for the entire system. So Chris Anderson and a bunch of guys working for free in their spare time over the course of a year decided they were going to see if they could, you know, outdo the military. So a year later, they had a device that has 90% of the functionality of the military's Raven. It costs $300. They're now trying to get the price below $100. Now you say, okay, so they built a remote control airplane that's really high-tech. Neat. What's the big deal? So a couple things are the big deal. One, if you're doing environmental work, for example, in Siberia, and you want to take care of tigers, one of the biggest problems is Siberia is enormous. There's no possible way to pay enough people to patrol it. But with cheap UAVs, you can put UAVs in the air, and one person with $1,000 worth of remote-controlled aircraft can patrol for tigers. Now, that's one example. Another example is a new company called Matternet. They're doing this in Haiti, but it actually was developed for Africa. But Matternet had a really simple idea. So in Africa, a lot of people are suffering from AIDS. They are on very, very tight medical schedules. They have to take X amount of drugs every day at very specific times. This is a problem because in Africa, one-third of the roads wash out every year. So there are no roads anywhere for half the year. So if you're on a very tight medical regimen, how are you going to get your drugs? So Matternet has teamed up with local hospitals and doctors, and what they've done is they've taken abandoned railroad car containers, they put solar recharging stations in them, they've got the UAV drones on top of the recharging station. You need your meds, you call up the hospital on your cell phone, you pay for your meds on your cell phone, the drone leaves the charging station, goes and picks up your medicine for you and brings it to you in your house. This is a huge, huge deal. This is the kind of leverage that we are now finding among individuals. So this brings us to our third force, which is who is paying for all this innovation. Third force we're calling the techno-philanthropists. These are individuals. This is kind of the new era robber baron, the new philanthropist. These are people who have the wealth of nation states, yet as this quote makes clear, they face none of the shortfalls of government. And unlike the robber barons of old who were very interested in seeing their names on buildings, today's techno-philanthropists are very interested in spending their money on the world's grand challenges. So Bill Gates is a very famous example, crusading against malaria, crusading for vaccines. Jeff Skoll, one of the eBay founders, is another one. He's working to fight against nuclear proliferation and pandemics. This list goes on and on and on and on. More money is going into philanthropy today than ever before in history. In 2004, just to give you an idea, it was $248 billion. It's the most money ever. 2 years later, it was up to $295 billion, and CNBC called it the new golden age of philanthropy. Now, during the recession, of course, those numbers came down a little bit, but they're shooting back up again, higher and higher and higher. And unlike philanthropy of old, it's no longer I write the check and I'm done. It's I write the check and I start. When Bill Gates was crusading against malaria, he wasn't just doling out money. He was getting into meetings with the World Health Organization, with leaders of nations. People have a lot more leverage than anybody expects. And another, by the way, just another kind of example of this that's good is impact investing or triple bottom line investing. This is investing in companies that don't just want to make a profit, but also want to do a social good. So right now, the triple bottom line investing market is roughly $50 billion, which is pretty substantial. It is slated by the end of the decade to get up to $1 trillion. This is a colossal amount of money being spent on solving global grand challenges. So I want to talk about, before I get to our fourth force, I want to kind of talk about what this money is already leveraging. And I want to, if the title of the book is Abundance, and I want to give you an example of something that is actually already abundant, which is the spread of information and communication technology. So I want you to think about this. Right now, today, a Maasai warrior on a cell phone has in the middle of Kenya has access to better communication technology than the President of the United States did 25 years ago. That's Reagan. If they are on a smartphone with access to Google, they have access to better information than the President of the United States did 15 years ago. That's Clinton. That's astounding. And there are a lot of these phones. A decade ago, Nigeria had 100,000 landlines. The company that was responsible for those landlines, it's out of business now. Today, Nigeria has 100 million cell phones. Cell phones in Rwanda last year went up by a 50% increase. In Kenya, cell phones last year went up by 500-fold. By the end of 2013, 70% of the globe will be connected online. So why is this such a big deal? A lot of different reasons. This is impacting everything, agriculture in Africa. People can now call ahead and get crop prices can get market prices for their crops. Huge impact on family income. We've got better disaster management, better entertainment, and banking. Mobile banking is a great, great, great example. There are 2.7 billion people in the world without access to general banking services. And enter online banking, which, as you know, allows you to check your accounts and receive payments, do all these things via your cell phone. This is a huge deal. In Kenya alone, people who have access to mobile banking services have seen their household income go up 5 to 30% a year. This is a huge deal. So this brings us to our fourth force, which is the rising billion, the so-called bottom billion, the poorest of the poor. These people are coming up. Let me back up. In 2010, 2 billion people were online. By 2020, that number is going to jump to 5 billion. That means 3 billion individuals are coming online by the decade's end. These are people we've never heard from before. We've never had access to their ideas. We've never had access to their minds. They are joining the global conversation for the very, very first time. These are 3 billion new inventors, new problem solvers, new partners, new customers. What do these people want? What do they desire? These are huge questions. Now, most people don't think so. They think, what impact could these people possibly have? Most of them live on less than $2 a day. It's true, but do the math. $2 a day, 365 days a year, times 3 billion. It's tens of trillions of dollars coming into the global economy every year. Nothing like this has ever, ever, ever happened before. And they're not, this is not the kind of poverty that we're used to. This is an entirely new kind of poor. So I want to talk about education for a second. As you probably know, 23% of all kids on the planet are not in school. This is a huge crisis. This is one of the guys who is working to solve this. This is Salman Khan. I don't know if you guys know his name. Salman Khan was a hedge fund manager in New York. He had a bunch of nieces and nephews, and he was tutoring them, and he decided to start making videos for them, educational videos. They were in high school, and he was making educational videos for them. He was started posting them on YouTube. They got very, very popular, so it became the Khan Academy, and he kept adding videos, and he kept adding videos, and he kept adding videos. It became an internet sensation. They've now got over 2,500 videos. More are added every day. And the goal is to be for everybody to be able to go from basic math through quantum physics online for free. Right now, you can probably go grade school through sophomore year in college online for free. The cool thing is, while the lectures right now are all in English, Google is translating them into 7 major languages, and then the Khan Academy is going to crowdsource them into hundreds more. And this, by the way, is only one, you know, example. Another one, MoMath, which is an instant messaging-based math tutoring program, already in South Africa 10 million active users. There are dozens and dozens and dozens more of these examples, as you probably know. Right now, MIT and Stanford are both dumping their entire course loads online for free. So what this means is those 3 billion new minds that are coming online are going to have access to a level of education unlike anything you could possibly imagine. But it's not just that they're going to be better educated, they're also going to be considerably healthier. So I don't know how many of you are Star Trek fans, or if you know what the tricorder is, but for anybody who was a Star Trek fan, the tricorder was a medical scanning device that Bones used, and you would basically wave it in front of a person who would tell you what was wrong with them. So my partner, Peter Diamandis, who I wrote Abundance with, who runs the XPRIZE, just started the Qualcomm $10 million tricorder XPRIZE to build the very first version of this. Now, this may sound like science fiction, a handheld device that can actually diagnose illness better than board-certified doctors sounds like fiction. It's actually based on three technologies that are already here today. And the first one is a technology you guys probably all heard of, which is Watson. Watson was the supercomputer that beat human contestants on Jeopardy a couple years ago. So the big deal about that is that Watson, to win on Jeopardy, had to understand what's called natural language, how are you and I talk. Jeopardy, you slang, puns, all those kinds of stuff. So it was the very first time a computer could actually understand natural language. So when Watson was done on Jeopardy, he's been sent to University of Maryland Medical School. And Watson is now being packed and packed and packed with medical information. Every journal, medical journal they can possibly find is being packed into Watson. And when it's done, Watson is going to be uploaded into the cloud. So this means that anybody can access Watson. So when you combine these two things, cloud computing and supercomputers, with what's called a lab on a chip. Now, a lab on a chip is essentially a microchip that you can put spit, urine, blood on, and it will break down the DNA and will analyze it, analyze the sample. So you can take a cell phone with a lab on a chip in it, put a drop of blood on it, it can analyze the DNA, shoot it up to Watson in the cloud, and Watson can ID your disease. So what's the big deal? There's a lot of big deals here. One of them is pandemics are a growing concern. So if Watson identifies a DNA in a disease it's never seen before, immediately places a call to the CDC, hopefully stops the pandemic before it starts. In America, with healthcare costs spiraling, and 45% of the time that you go to the doctor, they get the diagnosis wrong, this is going to save millions and millions and billions of dollars. But in parts of the world where there are no doctors and there are no nurses, and suddenly you're bringing diagnostic medicine to them, this is an astounding, astounding, astounding bit of leverage. So we're talking about 3 billion new minds coming online. They're going to be better educated. They're going to be healthier than ever before. They have access to technologies like cloud computing and 3D printing. They're going to be more productive than ever before. The really big deal here is the amount of leverage this gives us. And it gives us contributions we absolutely cannot predict coming out of places we can't see coming. And I want to give you one example before I end tonight. And it's my favorite story about middle of nowhere breakthroughs. So for those of you who don't know, does anybody, protein folding mean anything to anybody? So how you take two-dimensional amino acids, what are essentially two-dimensional amino acids, and fold them together into a protein, this is a protein that you're looking at, the 3D structure of a protein, is critical because the structure of a protein determines its function. So for drug discovery, for medical technology, these are huge issues, how protein folds, how proteins fold. It's also extremely, extremely difficult and complicated. And until a few years ago, it was a supercomputer problem, and that was the only way to do it. And then a bunch of grad students at the University of Washington in Seattle said, God, you know, we've got pattern recognition systems in the human brain, and humans are pretty good at identifying patterns, so let's see if they're any good at protein folding. So they turned protein folding into a game. They called it Fold It. Anybody can sign up to play. They put it on the internet. Hundreds of thousands of people have signed up to play, and astounding progress has been made. Just, this isn't my point, but I'll tell you a story. A couple years ago, there was an AIDS-producing enzyme. So it's actually found in monkeys that had stumped scientists for 13 years. They could not figure out the structure of this protein. They couldn't do anything. In 10 days, a bunch of people online working in their spare time, again for free, got together a couple years ago. They figured out the structure of this protein in 10 days. And it's now today being used for drug development. That's amazingly fast drug discovery and is really, really neat. But the point I'm making is a couple years after that, guys from the University of Washington went, okay, so we've been doing this for a while. We've gotten great results. Who's the best protein folder in the world? So they went to look. They did not find an MIT graduate student. They did not find a Caltech professor. They found Suzanne, a middle-aged woman from Manchester, England, who by day is an executive secretary at a rehabilitation clinic, and at night is the world's best protein folder. And she had no idea she had this talent. This is the kind of leverage we're going to get all over the place from 3 billion minds coming online. And the reason this is so critical, the four forces I've discussed tonight, the power of exponential technology, the DIY inventor, the DIY innovator, the techno-philanthropist, and the rising billion, can absolutely get this job done. We have what we need, but this is not a techno-utopias book. It's not a techno-utopias lecture. Technology alone will absolutely not get this done. This does not happen by technology alone. I talked about four forces tonight. One of them was technological. The other three are biological. This is going to require the largest cooperative effort in history, but it's absolutely possible. Abundance for all really is within our grasp. It's just going to take a tremendous amount of work. So let's get busy. Thank you so much.